This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles. Positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. In her space, safe space in Whakatane is Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Dr. Karatai.
Kia ora, Professor Mann. How are you?
Very well indeed. We are going again with the Coming Up for Air.
Yes, this is proving very popular, Coming Up for Air. So, I've just been quite amazed re-listening to everybody as they're coming on, and yeah, just feel very proud of some pretty clever thinkers, and that I'm super excited today to introduce Mr. Julian Smith. Julian, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
How are you today?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, Julian. Where are you, Julian?
So yeah, currently based in Rotorua at the moment.
Rotorua. Currently based, is that not home?
Yeah, it's home at the moment, but haven't been here always, just living here. I've been living here for the past 2 years and living here now at the moment.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up here, and then I moved down south, studied in Dunedin for 5 years back in 2016 and came back in here up to Rotorua in 2021.
What was it like growing up in Rotorua?
Yeah, it's good. I really enjoyed the lifestyle here. Living by the lakes and the forest and whatnot, definitely lots to do, outdoors activities and whatnot. And yeah, had really good schooling and a good environment to be in, good culturally and a good diverse mix of people.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
I didn't have a set career in mind that I specifically wanted to be from a young age. I had things I wanted to do when I left high school, like I went down to the Dunedin and I studied health science first year, and from there I wanted to do medicine, but went to pharmacy and studied health science from that, and obviously pursuing a similar master's degree in business. So like, yeah, I think what I wanted to do career wise certainly changed as I've progressed throughout life, and it's just based on what I've learned and the knowledge I've gained from the world and the current events that are going on.
So what do you do now when you're not studying?
I work for an electric bike company, so deal with renting out bikes to customers and a lot of overseas clientele, and also work on the operation side of things, maintenance-wise on the bikes. And then I do a lot of trail running. I'm really into trail running, and I compete in national events and that. And obviously, do the study as well.
One of those bit long races is in Rotorua, isn't it? Is that sort of thing you do?
They have quite a few. They have the Tabawita Trail Ultra, which is a really renowned event. It's been running for around 10 years, I think, now. And they have a few other ones, off-road ones and the Rotorua Marathon and whatnot. But yeah, and they also have the Xterra, which runs commonly in April each year, and that's been a recurring popular event. So I usually do that. And yeah, it's the ideal place for it with the redwoods and whatnot and being close to the lakes. Kind of like the perfect place for an off-road triathlon kind of thing.
You'd have no excuse for not getting out there.
Yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, it works out with my lifestyle, like complements the study and as well, I feel, and also the work.
Is this e-bikes company a newish thing?
Yeah, it's definitely new. Like, e-bikes have been quite popular now, weren't so much 5 years ago. Definitely have gained a lot of popularity just in the past few years. People just realizing that they're really similar to normal bike, and especially the new models that are coming out that handle the tracks, really similar to normal bike as well, weight-wise and maneuverability and whatnot.
And it's opened up a whole chunk of the landscape to people that they couldn't get to before.
Yeah, exactly. And it, yeah, kind of gives you that flexibility and peace of mind. If you go for a ride, you've got that capacity to just not be as focused on the fatigue side of things. But obviously, you get the exercise as well, the benefit. And also, obviously, for like Asia, older demographics and whatnot, it's appealing for that, in that aspect, I think.
How's the supply of e-bikes going in terms of sustainability choices?
You mean in terms of manufacturing? Are they able to keep a supply at the moment? Or? Yeah, I think there's definitely a demand for them. People are using them a lot more for transport, especially on the roads and in urbanized areas. I know a lot, especially in Europe, using them a lot. And they have like dedicated cycle lanes and whatnot. I think they're definitely becoming more popular in that regard. And yeah, like especially on some of the new models coming out, you can get easily 100 plus Ks commuting wise. Plus, obviously, if the battery runs out, you can just use it like a normal bicycle. So it's really appealing in that regard.
And was it the e-bike company that led you to the Masters in Sustainable Business?
Not specifically. I already had that in mind before I started working there. But, yeah, definitely complements that side of things as well.
So what led you to that route?
Interest in sports, mountain biking.
To sustainable business, I mean.
Sustainable business. Applying it. I want to further my study, do postgrad study, definitely. And I feel like, it's something that's really relevant to the current global landscape and certainly an interest in trying to make a difference in that regard.
Does that stem from your passion for the outdoors and the environment?
Yeah, I definitely say it stems from that.
Alrighty, let's take your music track, and I can't read my writing. You're going to have to tell me what we're playing, because it matters what I say, because it's not in English.
The song's called Experience. It's a piano orchestral song. It's quite long. Not sure if you're going to play the whole thing or...
We'll try.
Yeah, you can play the first section at least. Yeah, it's a really good, really good song.
Bubble Sprite of the Forest of Orokanui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu McKenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aroha nui, kia koutou, ko tahua hou. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proven to be very rewarding, very sustaining and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique and here, making things better. Thank you. Now I know that for us all the last several years have been very tough and our whole world, which we trusted and loved for so long, has changed. And we find ourselves now in a new environment, in a new world, a changed world. However, so much of the world that is eternal and unchanging still surrounds us, and this can be a great comfort in these times of uncertainty and in these times of recalibration and restructuring. The world continues to turn. The sun continues to shine. The night continues to fall. The moon continues to rise. The stars continue to twinkle. The wind continues to blow. The sea continues to create the most beautiful song, the most beautiful sense of breath as the sea approaches the shore and moves back again. And so much in the immutable living world is a wonderful bedrock, is a wonderful foundation for us when we are feeling unstable and uncertain in the human world. And of course we have created the human world. It's a wonderful triumph for us as a species that we've been able to construct this very complex and life-sustaining human world, and that we are warm in our houses and all of these things. It is a great triumph. And it's so important when we do stand in that position of marvel at our creation, that we allow the sense of the creative energy of our species to inspire us to help others. I speak to you now from a cold day, and I think of those who will be cold today, and I hope that they can make their way to the night shelter in Dunedin and be fed and be cared for and be warm in their beds tonight. And of course we are so fortunate that even though so much has changed, so much has remained. I'm staying with my whānau at the moment on the peninsula, which is so beautiful, and I'm right by the sea and it's absolutely stunning. And the love of our family, of those who we choose to be our family, of course is so precious. And I was raised by three friends, so quite an unusual whānau situation. But it's worked very well for us. And so I've always known that we can choose our family, we can create the family that we want. And just being in the embrace of those that love us, allowing them to care for us, all these things make such a huge difference at this time. So I really hope for you that you're enjoying those aspects of our world which remain unchanged and remain there for you to sustain you and comfort you as we move through this process of recalibration and recovery. And being part of this show, of course, is a huge pleasure and privilege. So I'd love to thank Sam and the whole Blown Bubbles team for having me, and all of you, of course, for being part of this show too. And I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Julian Smith.
Julian, we're going to listen to your podcast now. What would you like the listeners to know about the podcast before they hear it? And is there anything in particular that you'd like them to listen out for?
I'd say, yeah, take the information and reflect on it on quite a deep level, especially in where our society is headed. Like, obviously climate change is something that's going to affect everyone inevitably in the future. And there's definitely things you can do on an individual level or try to influence other things that will certainly make a difference in the future.
So how would you describe what the podcast is about?
So the podcast is specifically focused on energy supplies and the security around that in the future. Currently, 60% of CO2 emissions come from fossil fuels and unsustainable energy supplies. So the impact this is going to have of these, if this not change to more efficient and renewable energy supplies in the future, so trying to find ways either to cut back on energy usage or a means to develop those renewable supplies faster to contribute to decreased climate emissions.
In this podcast, we will be talking about how energy production is related to decoupling emissions from GDP, and from the perspective of degrowth and decoupling, the implications this would have on society in regards to energy production. When we talk about decoupling in this context, we are talking about separating the link between energy production and environmental emissions, so that energy production would still occur at a capacity to meet or exceed societal demands, while the emissions associated with this production would decrease. The obvious outcome of this is renewable energy, which is well present and developing in many locations. However, the challenge comes from the low percentage of energy production that is currently renewable, and the time frame required to develop this infrastructure to prevent emissions from extending planetary boundaries. Added to this is the issue that many developing countries face, where developing countries use resources less efficiently than developed countries to progress their development. This remains a key issue, because without investment and development into renewables, countries will have to rely on non-renewables for energy productions. Equally, the emissions costs associated with progressing these renewable developments may be significant, so the challenge then becomes about balancing these two factors. Degrowth in the context of this problem refers to reducing production capacity to reduce emissions in order to circumvent the challenges associated with developing renewables. Talking about economic degrowth by referring to decreasing energy usage isn't something that is really practical. In Western societies where growth favors growth, incentivizing individual level behavioral changes by telling people it is beneficial to isn't going to reduce the level of changes needed to shift the emissions quota. We know that globally 70% of CO2 emissions come from energy productions, which is significant, so it gives a pathway to reduce emissions rapidly. Aspects of decoupling emissions from GDP and economic growth cannot be talked about without acknowledgement of this relationship, because economic growth is intrinsically linked to energy usage. Energy is important for growth because production is a function of capital, labor, and energy. Co-integration analysis has repeatedly shown that there is a co-integrating relationship between quality-weighted energy, GDP, labor, and capital, and that a mutual causation exists between energy and GDP. This relationship is only observed by the way these variables interrelate and can be explained by the laws of thermodynamics, the mass balance principle, and the efficiency law. The efficiency law implies that a minimum quantity of energy is required to carry out the transformational movement of matter. Carrying out transformation requires more energy than these minima. As all production involves a degree of these transformations, all economic activities must require energy. Studies have shown that energy intensity, access and security limit economic growth and degrade the environment. Energy depletion has been found to degrade the environment and discourage economic growth in the 10 most energy-efficient countries. Energy efficiency includes two main aspects, that to do with how energy is produced and that to do with how energy is used and distributed. Energy produced by renewables is significantly more efficient than that produced by non-renewables. Energy efficiency contributes to economic benefits directly, as well as decreasing emissions of pollutants and greenhouse gases. Some of these benefits include reduced production cost, increased energy security, and a reduced, more sustainable usage of resources required for production. The most effective pathway towards decoupling emissions from economic growth may lie in the focus on energy efficiency, focusing on the development of renewable production, while simultaneously implementing measures in energy distributions and services to enhance energy efficiency. This would simultaneously act to achieve environmental and economic goals. Added to this issue is the certainty of climate change and its effect on resource redistributions, many of which are directly linked to the production of renewable energy. Of specific concern is water redistributions, which are already affecting large areas which rely on hydro for energy production. Kariba Dam, the second largest hydropower dam in southern Africa, is at its lowest level since its development, resulting in extreme power cuts in Zambia and power rationing in Zimbabwe. This trend is increasing globally, with the energy security of many hydropower dams uncertain in the coming years.
Know much about the projects and whatnot?
Yeah, a fair bit. I mean, there's sort of two sides to it, really. The sort of main goal of the government with this sort of thing is putting the appropriate regulatory settings in and then letting other people do the investment.
Yep.
So we sort of try to encourage investment as opposed to directly investing ourselves.
Is a lot of that investment, is it local, overseas? Is there overseas interest in that? Or?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. I think there's a fair bit of sort of looking into offshore wind and things like that, which I think tends to be slightly more overseas. But again, the smaller scale things are a lot easier for local companies to be working on. So I think there's quite a lot of solar going on at the moment all over the place, and I think that tends to be more local. And then, yeah, these are all sort of short-term energy goals of kind of just increasing our overall capacity. And then, obviously, there are more long-term goals and risks about, you know, increasing electrification, how we're going to manage that, and how we're going to manage increasing renewables and the sort of intermittency issues that comes with that.
So, yeah, like with some of the projects you're mentioning, like looking forward for strategies for developing energy production, are there any like specific projects that would kind of be geared towards that decoupling side of things?
I mean, I think New Zealand is fairly lucky in that we've got so much hydro at the moment, and we've got the conditions that mean hydro can happen. So, I mean, that obviously means that, for the most part, hydro is actually quite cheap to produce, and it tends to just keep running. So I suppose that's not quite so much decoupling, because it probably already would have been the most efficient thing to go for. I think, so in electricity generation, there are sort of two main types, where one is the base load, which, you know, just is running the whole time and makes up the majority. And the other's sort of peaking and firming. So whenever there are peaks and troughs in electricity demand, what's going to pick up the slack? What sort of additional things can you turn on? And I think the peaking and firming is when fossil fuels become quite good, because they can ramp up and ramp down very quickly to adjust the changes in demand. So I think decoupling probably would come in more there as opposed to baseload, because again, in baseload, it's sort of already quite efficient to be using renewables, but fossil fuels are very good in this peaking firming role. So whether or not it's a case of over-investing or increasing investment sort of in baseload up to a point where that sort of firming stuff isn't really needed, or trying to think of alternatives to that, which again might be more expensive than using fossil fuels, but obviously it's that decoupling side of it then. Yeah, do you want me to talk about some of the possible alternatives to that sort of thing? Or?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah, so I mean, there was that whole thing a little while ago about the Lake Onslow pumped hydro scheme, which I think this government isn't overly interested in. I mean, because the costs were getting really quite high very quickly. But essentially the way that works is you've got a huge water storage, like a lake, up quite high. And then I think you've got a tunnel going down, possibly into a river below it. And you'll run the water down through the tunnel, through turbines, and that's kind of your classic hydro generation. But then when the sort of electricity price is low or demand's low, you pump the water back up out of the river into the lake. So essentially the lake then is acting like a gigantic battery. And obviously that's not overly efficient because you're having to spend money pumping it back up, like takes electricity to pump the water back up. But it's all about redistributing when you use it and kind of smoothing curves in that regard. And then there are sort of a whole bunch of other interesting technologies like supercritical geothermal and things like that.
So like when they make decisions around when to turn them on, is that just purely to meet like demand? They don't, they're like, yep, they always wanted to meet demand with that, so they'll just do it regardless.
Yeah, I think essentially. I don't think any government wants people to have power outages because there isn't enough generation.
Yep.
So I mean, yeah, first and foremost, the goal is keeping everyone's sort of lights on.
Like how meeting an energy demand for a country is beneficial in terms of development, sustainable development.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think to some extent it's not. I know South Africa has a horrendous sort of energy supply, but I suspect what it's really sort of come to is a growing expectation. So everyone's now become used to, you know, having a constant supply of electricity and always being able to rely on it. So the expectations shifted. I mean, if you go back 200 years ago, no one would have expected it. No one would have, you know, relied on it or thought they deserved it. But I mean, I suspect it is, that sort of reliability is linked in a lot of ways to people's sort of, you know, what they do, their productivity, their jobs. So I suspect, yeah, we have become reliant on it. And yeah, there is that changing sort of expectation.
So do you think like, yeah, without a meeting with a reduced energy capacity, do you think that would, you don't think that would negatively impact on how people like use resources and conduct their daily lives in an unsustainable way?
Well, I mean, it depends there if you're talking more about energy or electricity. I think electrifying, sort of going forwards and converting more and more things to sort of electricity definitely has sustainability advantages and I think can actually sort of reduce your overall energy consumption, you know, even if you're using more things that are electric. So, you know, sort of electric cars, solar and batteries in houses, all that sort of thing can, you know, reduce your reliance on natural gas and fuel. And maybe overall your, because I think electricity generated renewably would be more sustainable and more efficient. Because I think, yeah, when they talk about energy and electricity supply, one of the big things they talk about is the energy trilemma, which is trying to balance affordability, reliability, and sustainability. So I think that's a pretty big consideration in sort of any project that's undertaken by especially government, but also I'd say other companies.
Yeah, I was thinking, yeah, like more in terms of like a reduced capacity would mean like reduced capacity to develop infrastructure and whatnot. So yeah, not so much like, yeah, personal aspects as well, but also like aspects for the growth of like societies and whatnot. And yeah, like developing and production, yeah, for other technologies. Because I feel like
I think definitely
innovations definitely come from like, you could almost say like the privilege we have in our society to conduct research and whatnot, and that is kind of fueled, like accommodated by our lifestyle and like the ability to not worry about energy expenditure as such.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Yeah, do you have any like are you more towards like the degrowth side or the decoupling side of things?
I would have thought probably the decoupling side. I'd have thought degrowth as a whole is a slightly dangerous idea, and it's, you know, very clear as separately that GDP is a fairly poor measure, doesn't really take into account, you know, human living standards or anything like that. You know, so generally you could have a high economic growth, but also a terrible, population living standard. But it doesn't mean that it isn't still heavily linked to, those sorts of things. Whereas decoupling seems like you're still trying to achieve that kind of growth, but you're separating it out and focusing on the climate separately, and maybe balancing a different sort of regulatory regime about the climate side of things, so that the incentives are there for people to still be investing in, whatever sort of generation or climate-related activities.
Yeah, I'm definitely kind of like similar on that. My views is the complexity of how our society is ordered and has been ordered, historically, with the foundations of capitalism or whatnot. That's something you can't just disrupt overnight, and not even in 50 to 100 years.
Do you see what I said about Thomas Malthus before?
Oh, yeah.
I feel fundamentally, if you're saying degrowth needs to happen, you're saying that growth is going to, there are going to be negative implications from growth, like you're going to affect the climate negatively, sort of thing, which in some sort of way is what Thomas Malthus was saying, 200 years ago, in that he's saying, a continuously growing population is going to use up all the resources and negative impacts from all of that, and there'll be Malthusian events that wipe out the population and bring it back down. So in a way, it feels like they're kind of embracing that doom and gloom side of things, whereas I think Thomas Malthus's big shortcoming is he didn't really appreciate the sort of potential of changing technologies. And I think realistically, with sort of technology continuing to improve, decoupling would be able to achieve climate results if the incentives are there. I think if proper decoupling happens. I think degrowth probably is a overstep and would probably have negative impacts with it.
Yep.
Also, as with a reduced energy capacity, there would also be a reduced capacity to adapt and mitigate environmental and societal extremes. This could then lead to destructive cycles where, because of the existing reduced capacity, it may be harder to exit from diminishing cycles. For instance, in a large population, if essential services or resources became hindered due to extremes putting pressures on the energy capacity, it would then be harder to progress development than if a capacity surplus already existed. And also, I feel like unstable social structures could also amplify the effects of a limited energy supply, and this would obviously negatively affect the development of a country and limit its economic potential.
Yeah, I think to do decoupling properly, you obviously need proper incentives for it to happen, because I think then you're saying if the incentives are in place, capitalism will continue to do its thing while reducing emissions. I think the ETS is probably a loose example of it. I don't think anyone would say it's absolutely perfect, but trying to put a cost on carbon so that it balances in with the market, I think is a sensible idea in that regard.
To summarize on this, I feel like a society is evolving currently with how we become to produce and rely on energy. So to drastically alter this energy capacity through reduced production, it's going to have implications at every level of how society functions. From the degrowth aspect, decisions would need to be made about what energy would be considered expendable to uphold the quality of life, versus that expendable to maintain the functions necessary for existence. And this is highly complex, because these variables interrelate in ways that aren't always clear. To what extent is our ability to relate to one another in a meaningful and productive way dependent on the way our society is constructed around the availability of resources and services? And if our behaviours are highly dependent on the current environment, at what point will a reduced capacity start to push societal changes toward negative and destructive outcomes? If regions are to attempt this, will they be able to recover if things don't go as planned?
Julian, thank you very much. That was a really interesting and insightful interview. Can you tell me what was your big takeaway from that?
A big takeaway from that is definitely the urgency around the current situation ecologically and on the climate side of things, and how, yeah, it's going to take a collaborative effort from everyone to actually make a difference and meet the climate target goals.
Do you think that we're going to be able to do it?
Yeah, it's quite hard to say from like a situational, subjective perspective, because there's a lot of things that can be unpredictable in that regard, especially in the future context. But yeah, like just keep an optimistic mindset. I don't really think there is an alternative. Like either we try and meet the threshold or meet it to a degree, or we don't and collapse into a kind of like ecological catastrophe. And who knows, maybe yeah, the potential extinction of more things. So in that regard, yes, you have to be optimistic.
Yeah, you do indeed. So how do you think we get the message out there? What is the best pathway for getting the message out there so that people actually take this seriously?
I think, yeah, definitely talking about the consequences, like if failing to meet those targets, like what's going to happen. Already we're noticing severe weather differences, and that's going to increase exponentially with just even minimal fluctuations of temperature changes. So just, yeah, highlighting those impacts to people and like, yeah, this is a reality. If things aren't changed in the next 10 to 20 years, then those are going to become a problem, become part of reality, and that's going to have severe impacts for communities across the globe.
I think I don't know that I've got this 100% correct, but I just read something that said that in the last 30 days the last 50 days, the 30 highest temperatures ever recorded in the whole history of recording temperatures, in Egypt.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That blew my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
It's just so hot. It was 50 degree days, basically.
Yep. That's just the best evidence you can get that those things are, that these things are happening, and they're getting worse over time as well.
Yeah. So if you were the boss of everything and you could go to the people who...
You mean he's not?
Not yet. Maybe someday soon. But if you were the boss of everything and you could go to the people who have the power to make change, or the most important people, what age are they? What's that? What is the change age?
I said the change age is still with the people in power, to be honest, because those big level changes are only going to come from the overseeing people in the big CEOs of corporations and obviously world leaders. But then there are the younger generation, which can influence it to an extent, but I definitely think the power is still in those people, the older generation, who hold those positions of power.
Of the three of us sitting in this chat today, Sam and I are 1 or 2 years older than you. So you're definitely the youngest in this space. Does your generation feel empowered to make change?
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, like because it is a reality, it's something that's happening now, the next 10 to 20 years, and it's going to have severe impacts on our current life. So, yeah, definitely in that regard, we do feel motivated.
Before you were talking about world leaders as having the power to make change, how do we create some sort of system where world leaders can make decisions that are best for the planet and not best for their re-election? What has to change for that to be the case?
I think because of the urgency and the factual evidence about climate change, those two things are becoming more correlated than was in the past. So there's going to be a downside to not going with the collective perspective.
Yep, I think that's right. But
Which is definitely a positive.
It is definitely a positive.
I think in that regard, highlighting it and keeping the momentum going and talking about it will further incentivize those political changes.
Yep, you're exactly right.
I have some questions to end the show. Julian, what is the biggest success you've had in the last year or so?
Finding a rhythm that works in regards to a lifestyle that I'm comfortable with, around that suits my activities. And applying this in how I conduct myself.
What is your superpower?
Being able to have a focus and discipline that allows me to achieve tasks when I put my mind to it.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
An activist in regards to, I like standing up for issues that affect everyone and are standing up for the vulnerable and marginalized, but not an activist as in marching down the street and leading a protest to that degree.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
What motivates me is my enjoyment for the things I do and the passion to make a difference for a collective good.
Oh, I was going to ask that before. Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
Yeah, I like the one about meeting the demands, the needs of the present generation without compromising the future generations. But I think meeting the demands could also be correlated with meeting the demands to achieve a sufficient or high quality of life, of standard of living. Because you can meet the demands, but that might hinder your capacity to live a high quality of life or just a comfortable standard of living.
I think the problem is the unequal distribution of that high quality of life.
Yeah, so not so much high quality in material accessibility, excessive consumption, whatnot. I mean high quality in terms of just having sufficient resources and being able to live in a safe community. We don't have to worry about constantly being burdened by negatives such as substandard infrastructure and suboptimal developments and whatnot.
So what's the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
I don't have specific opportunities I'm looking forward to because I don't have those things planned as far yet, but just definitely anything that comes my way, I like to seize the opportunity and maximize on it. So I can just incorporate that into my life and to try to just go for something that comes along and have a good mindset towards it.
Yep.
But nothing pre-planned as such.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yeah, advice for listeners is obviously in the context of this kind of topic of the podcast is the world is definitely quite a fragile state, I feel. At this point in history, and there's the potential to make a change. I think it's definitely going to need a lot of people who are keen to do that and keen to invest time and energy in that.
Cool. Thank you for that. Mawira.
Julian, I just wanted to say thank you very much for your contribution to our shared learning space over the course of the Masters program. You are a very deep thinking human being, and it comes out in your work and with some cool ideas, like actually my favorite of all of the paper before last, where everybody had to do an action research project, and Julian's was on everybody in the household taking cold showers instead of hot showers and the environmental impact of that simple decision. I just couldn't imagine getting my family to do that.
Yeah.
At least it would save us money. It would save us water and power.
I was really surprised about that, to be honest. Just how it made you feel. And after a while, it definitely got a lot easier. I didn't expect that, which was definitely positive.
It was just so out there and wonderful. And that's just you. You're a really good human being. And it's been a real joy to get to know you through your work and through your contribution to our classroom. And I just want to wish you all the best for the future, and may you continue to do good work. Kia ora.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you very much. I've definitely thoroughly enjoyed the study to this day so far.
Thank you for that. We're going out to Queen's Bicycle Race.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like. You say black, I say white. You say bar, I say bite. You say shark, I say him. And yours was never my scene, and I don't like Star Wars. You say Rose, I say Royce. You say God, give me a choice. Say Lord, I say Christ. I don't believe in Peter Pan, Frankenstein, or Superman. All I wanna do is
you've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on opr.org.nz. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. This was another program in our series coming up for air. That one that was brought to you by Julian Smith. With Moira Karatai, I'm Simon Mann. That's Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Ngā tewa.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.